Well,
okay, so let's start. 4 past 8 in the morning, well time for a lecture. Oh my God. Good, so yesterday we talked about games, obviously, right? And first of all, there were some complaints by people from the audience that there was too much talking, so that they could not concentrate and listen. Well, that's just what I must give back to the audience. Think about it. Well, it's not about discipline, as I said. It's just about efficiency, right? And I presume that people that have the energy to show up at 8:15 in the morning are less inclined for that. But I don't know. Well, it's not. As I said, I cannot emphasize that enough. Because it's really not about discipline. It's not about discipline. You can do whatever you want, right? And remember, I'm just the learning facilitator. I'm not the whatever inquisitory instance. However, people just came down to me and said, well, it's too loud, I cannot listen, so just think of that, and maybe we can turn down the noise level. Probably you're the wrong audience. I'm going to repeat this on Tuesday, right? So, cool. So, yesterday we started the actual lecture, and starting points were perspectives on digital games from the ludologist's perspective. We said that, okay, well, since ludology claims to be a science or is a science, it has to use certain methodologies which kind of induce a more academic view, which might sometimes be a little bit astray in terms of characterizing the latest trends really correctly. So the whole field is an evolving field, and so science is struggling to keep up with that, okay? The main goal of our considerations was to characterize games from a more general perspective, and especially to characterize their social aspects, right? Because we're social gaming and social computing lectures, so that's what's in our focus. However, we also talked about player types and components of games, mechanics, aesthetics, and stuff like that. So this is more like a conceptual framework on the basis of which we're going to work, right? And right now here, this is the point where we pretty much stopped, because we said, okay, our framework for games consisted of game types, and today we're going to look at game genres, at least a very little bit. And the types were a two-tuple of beta type and actual type, right? Which is here on the slide. And this is just an attempt to really bring up a course classification schema. As I said, if the classes are overlapping, they're probably not complete. However, these are the most interesting categories that we find social aspects in. So it's not, this categorization does not necessarily claim to be really a typology for the games in total, right? We also talked about more philosophical aspects, such as what is playing, what are games, and I think the take-home message from that was it's not easy to define, right? So playing is an activity that is at the heart of our human existence. We can see that. Small children play, we play, everything is play. Okay, good. So we're... the story that we're heading towards is that, in a sense, social games and social media kind of flow together. And my personal vision is that these communication-oriented social media and the more entertaining-oriented games will more or less flow together. Like, whatever, interactive movies that people really act in, that people are truly immersed in, not only from an audience perspective, but also from an acting perspective. So that's
the transition that you can see on the web, which we will look at today.
So the passage web 1.0, the classic, I do a home page, I do the HTML page, to the web 2 that we see today. And the same was true for games, from the solitary nerdy Pac-Man age to the World of Warcraft age.
And with the advent of mobile devices, the real and virtual worlds would also more flow together, right? So the ultimate vision is that once we integrate sensors, once we integrate mobility, things will flow together even more, right? And the possibilities of these things are really manifold, and there's also a lot of business models in there, obviously. So Hollywood is kind of converging towards games, not converging, but discovering the realm of games. And the games industry is taking up the methods of Hollywood in terms of scripting, design, and you know that games would cost as much as a Hollywood movie, at least the big ones, right? So that's this convergence we assume to be happening, and that's the story we're heading towards, right? Now, having spoken of types of games, the second pillar on which we would rest our classification schema is genre, right? So you might wonder what's the difference between a type and a genre. Well, coming from art history, you would say that a type of an art object is, for example, sculpture, painting, performance, whatever. And there's even things like artistic styles, which are also, in a sense, part of the type, right? So you could say that in Impressionist landscape painting is one type of art form, or a expressionist theater play is another art form, right? Or whatever, a cubist sculpture, whatever, right? And as a orthogonal axis to that, there are genres, right? For example, there's sujets, right, as what is depicted, is it a church or something, and there is things as, well, I'm a bit confused right now, because, okay, well, let's skip it for the moment. I'm a bit confused. I'll get back to this next time. Okay, good. So let's put this aside. However, genres of digital games, right? It would not be for me, but there were a lot of ludologists that came up with genre frameworks as well, right? So examples are listed on that slide. So there were several authors that thought about these issues. And as for typologies of games, there's also a lot of classification frameworks for genres, right, which are, in a sense, these orthogonal classification axes. Yeah? So as we see, action games, adventure, strategy, simulation, role-playing, puzzles, that's what they think is maybe an exhaustive listing. However, as you might have already seen, these things are not always up to date, right? They're not timeless. In a sense, the more recent developments in games kind of make these things outdated. Furthermore, there are not so much formal criteria. Right? And that's what we are interested in as computer scientists, and that is what this lecture is also heading to. So for those of you that are more interested in mathematical structures, we'll leave that soft realm of humanities soon enough, right? So in the upcoming lectures, we'll be dealing with probability theory, graph theory, machine learning, all these things. So for us, we like to be formal in terms of our criteria. Well, these things are certainly not, okay? Furthermore, what you, if you're trying to come up with a taxonomy for something, so a taxonomy for the moment being is just a tree-like classification schema,
where the edges are usually subsumption edges. Yeah? So
an element in a tree that's below another element, so the sum of a node, is usually considered a subclass, or a subgenre in this case. But you know that there is a lot of other edges that can play a role in these ontological frameworks. Another typical edge semantics is merely, which is a part of private access. Really.
So a wheel, for example, is part of a car, but it's certainly not a subclass. And for game genres, this might also apply. There's certain things, so the last time we saw that this magic circle, which kind of delineates or demarks the game from the rest of the world, is coming blurred as well, right? So there's games within games, so games can be part of other games, which kind of suggests that we would be better off with a more graph-like structure here instead of tree-like structures, okay? And the last point is that these genres are more empirical. They're more, they have an observational character, whereas in terms of formal criteria, we would like to have a more intentional description, meaning that we would like to have something that describes structural criteria. There's this typical extensional characterization of classes. So if you want to build an ontology, for example, and you have concepts like A, for example, you can give extensional descriptions of the class A by presenting like 500 A's, either as images or quite physical, and that would correspond to more sub-symbolic machine learning-like thinking, yeah? So your class is described via its instances, and these instances have features. And the semantics of that features do not necessarily have to be explicit in a certain sense. I mean, they are explicit, but they're not logically explicit in a sense, right? Whereas I can also define an A intentionally, meaning from using logic, okay? So an A is a mammal that has two arms, two legs, two eyes, one nose, one mouth, and it feeds from bananas and so on and so on. So in order to do that, you need to have other concepts. If I say an ape is a mammal, I need to define what a mammal is, okay? A mammal is a multicellular organism that blah, 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 blah. Yeah? An arm is a substructure of a multicellular organism that has three joints and blah, blah, blah. Right? So in that way, you would be more in the realm of predicate logic, first order logic, semantic web, and these things. And it's an interesting question, open question, I think, how to unite these two worlds in a sense. And that's what we are trying to do in various research projects. And so this is also here missing in terms of the genre classification, right? Instead of trying to come up with a super sophisticated, either extensional or intentional or graph-based or tree-based classification, we could use our components of games in a more intelligent way. And one way is to come up with a genre classification based on game mechanics. Okay?
So game mechanics, besides aesthetics and all other elements, are the, like the mechanical functioning frameworks of games. And this guy, Kostikians, defined that a genre is defined just by a shared collection of core mechanisms. Okay? So, in a sense, we could say genres are sets of games mechanics. And the beauty of that definition is that you can easily add new mechanics. And while the actual genres might have the dynamic development, the actual core mechanics are kind of fixed. Okay, and we'll see examples of that. So fixed in the sense of not changing too dynamically. So if there's a new mechanic that came up, we can just add it and then have games described in terms of that new component as well. Okay? Good. And one observation is, okay, good, genres are certainly still derived from pioneer games, but not empirically in that sense, but more with respect to the game mechanics. Okay? So, obviously there is a lot of ways to describe game mechanics, and Jarvin came up with 40 types of game mechanics, or at least, 40 tags describing game mechanics. Well, what could that be? For example, the first one, a game that deals with accelerating and decelerating effects, with aiming and shooting, allocating, arranging, searching, herding, information seeking, jumping, maneuvering, point-to-point movement, submitting, substituting, taking, trading, voting, whatever, right? So these things are described in these gerunds, implying that the underlying verbs imply the dynamics that characterize the mechanical elements, and you see they're very basic. Yeah? Motion is certainly something that is very general in itself. So these things, these types, or these gerunds, tags, whatever you want to call them, are certainly also not exclusive. They're not subdivisions in a sense. They overlap, and they also have subsumption relations among them. Yeah. The one example for that, if you take these rather old games, real-time strategy games, they would contain elements of attacking, defending, building, placing, arranging, conquering, information seeking, operating, and point-to-point movement, okay? And you can be creative if you think that this is not a very complete or a very well-suited description framework. Try to come up with an own description framework, right? Which is not cynical, but just an invitation to think of what is your experience with games, does that fit in there, and can we, in a sense, accept it, right? Good. So, this is just a very short look into game genres, right? And so, we said, okay, good, a game is described by its type, by its genre, and with all these additional descriptive elements around. Now, to give a summary up to that, okay, we can pretty much stick to the definition of Frasca, which is pretty general. For the moment, that's our working definition. So, a game is an engaging activity in which the players have or believe to have active participation, which contain rules and which operate with social status and quantified outcome. Okay? That's a very important thing that we're going to go back in a few moments. Okay? And the activity in the game constrains the future of the players to a set of probable scenarios, and the players are kind of willing to tolerate these scenarios. What does that mean? Okay? So there's outcomes of the game, and the set is rather finite. And the players would accept that in the sense of I'm playing the game, so that's what just what happens, okay? Which is also a parallel in a sense, to social media, because people would willingly accept the limitations and simple models that these services impose upon them, right? One example is Facebook friendships, okay? We all know the limitations of Facebook friendships as a model for social relations. However, people are willing to accept them as a modeling primitive, okay? We said that we have four types, and for meter types, the four types are described as vectors of meter types, and the genres are either ludologically described genre frameworks, or better than that, subsets or vectors in a taxonomy of game mechanics. So that's our working definition, right? Now, to conclude this look at games, we will look at several descriptive aspects, and these descriptive aspects are naturally targeted towards the social domain. So one interesting descriptive aspect axis is the socio-psychological domain. So here we are dealing with things like motivation, flow, fun, emotions, and these things are in a sense worth modeling, okay? So you might say, good, I'm a game designer, I do a script, I do a sketch, I do a storyboard, and in these sketches and storyboards and designs, I try to anticipate the related emotions, the related motivational structure of players and so on, and that's done in a very informal way, right? So when you sketch, you write the additional text at the side of the sketch, or some explanations and arrows, and that's all very implicit, right? And there's textual descriptions in a sense. If I offer the player this and this possibility, I assume that he will kind of experience some sort of fear, because, well, I'm creating a 3D dungeon which is very dark and the monsters are coming in suddenly and so on and so on, and I want to create flow by having the user be really immersed and having clear objectives, clear feedbacks and so on. But that's just at the textual description level. Yeah. Now, it might be interesting to also incorporate these things with more formal models. And that's what, for example, Daniel Gruen tries to achieve with his emotion engine and his emotion algebras. So that's not at the textual level, but more at the formal level. And we're currently, I'm currently supervising some bachelor's thesis which try to come up with social interaction descriptions that are at that formal level. Naturally, they would be kind of, rough formalizations of something that's very complicated, but on the other hand, they provide you with interesting possibilities to simulate, for example. And the social domain is really ideally suited for that, because our social conventions kind of bind us to certain behaviors and certain interaction patterns. And one of these students is currently doing this using the example of online dating, because in online dating there is a clear description of the participating parties, of their limited interests that they can have, and the limited set of behavioral interactions and emotions that can be involved like that, right? So disappointment, for example, if I write 10 messages, nobody writes back, I'm disappointed, that's almost a mechanical consequence, right? So it's interesting to look at the socio-psychological domain a bit more close, okay? Good. So there is some citations from a wide range of people. So Plato states that you can learn more about a person when you observe them playing than in the year of conversation. And Ovid, which is another classic that people know from their Latin courses at school. In our play, we reveal what kind of people we are. And Sutton Smith, the ludologist, says that the opposite of play isn't work, it's just depression, which kind of states that we can view pretty many of our activities as playful explorations. That applies to social media as well as to games. Okay? Okay, good. And the last one kind of emphasizes what I said at the beginning, that the emotional aspects of games are spilling over into the real world, right? So this emphasizes this flowing together of real, virtual, mobile, non-mobile, movies, games, and all these entertainment and communication aspects. Okay? Good. Good. So we'll look at several things, emotions, motivation, and flow, and fun, and stuff. So just let's do that. Okay? Good. There's an observation by Radov which kind of states that although we're also having this nerdy, hardcore, lonesome, ego shooter type of player, but he says that most players develop into socializers over time. And why is that? Because even the most hardcore autistic, ego shooting type of player will one time, if he's really into the game, will try to compete with others. Yeah? And that's typical. So the guys that are really skillful at those nerdy games would form like groups that kind of compete against each other in the end. So he and others kind of applied the insights that exist in social psychology with respect to motivation and distilled three motivational components that massively online multiplayer games would have while playing these games, or the cause of why they're playing these games. So the first one is the achievement-motivated player, and his desire is just to advance, to get better, to master the game mechanics, and focus on getting better, right? A little bit towards competition, but the classic motivational types described in social psychology would distinguish between the achievement-motivated person and the so-called power-motivated person. And the power-motivated person is someone that tries to be better than others, okay? So the distinction is that achievement-oriented or achievement-motivated person competes against herself, tries to get better, whereas the power-motivated wants to be better than others. And this is, in a sense, kind of blurred together here, right? Now, they also describe socially-motivated persons, which is one of the classical motivational types from social psychology. So here it's about socialization, getting together with others, doing teamwork, and so on. Okay? And the third motivational component or type that they state is this desire for being immersed, right? So the desire for being entertained, for being sucked up into the game, the motive of escapism, right? Escape from the real world. Good. However, there are other chances or other axes that we could use to describe motivation. One axis that most of you might know is the distinction between intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation. So intrinsically motivated persons come up with an interest in something because of, well, internal motives, yeah? So they have pleasure in the means and the activity itself, yeah? Whereas the extrinsically motivated persons are goal-oriented persons. So it's not, for example, if you cook, right? If you cook a meal, the intrinsically motivated person would, in a sense, have fun in just
kind of doing things, chopping onions, frying whatever components, and the extrinsically motivated person would say, okay, well, I like cooking, but I like cooking because I want to eat the nice things that I produce. So certainly these things are not totally clear.
It's, for example, in the field of learning, it's more clear. Yeah. So the intrinsically motivated students would have a pleasure from the studying activity itself, whereas the typically extrinsically
motivated student would just say, okay, I have to undergo this stupid social game lecture because I want to have the bachelor. I want to have, I'm doing whatever it takes. I don't care. Yeah? So this is extrinsic motivation.
Now, another thing is to describe motivation in terms of needs, okay? And the classical model for formalizing needs is Maslow's need pyramid or need hierarchy, okay? And so it's built up, as it says, in the pyramid fashion. So the basis is the needs that are kind of really at the core of it. So the physiological needs. So you need to breathe, you need to have water, you need to have nutrition. So these are the physiological needs. Otherwise, you know, we're going to die. Next level, safety. So we want to live in a law-oriented or law-protected environment. We don't want to live in an anarchy where each moment a bunch of guys would come in and all stuff machine guns, so we want to be safe. Next one, belonging love. So that's the social level, right? There's the sexual component and there's also the social component. We want to have friends and we want to have partners. Okay? And if that's secured, so that's always if one level is secured, your needs kind of travel or expand to the next level. And if your social setting is solved in a sense, you're at the level of self-esteem, right? So if you want to build self-esteem, you want to be a self-confident person, and the top level is self-actualization, Selbstverwirklichung, right? I want to kind of know who I am and what my purpose in life is and where I can make an impact. Right? So that, that's the highest philosophical, the highest level of need. And naturally, gains would typically belong in the self-esteem and belonging love level. More in the self-esteem level, like I can master the game mechanics is an element of that. And the societal or social issues, I want to kind of connect to others in WOW or something like that. Yeah? So these are the typical levels for player needs and resulting motivation. Good. So, other ways to describe them, these player motivations, are in terms of motives. Okay? So that's a little orthogonal to what we had. And these are more tagging-like descriptions. So Reis came up with 16 of these motives. Yeah? Power, curiosity, independence, romance, family, and so on. And we see that these motives are compatible with the aforementioned classification schemes. So some of them we could attribute more to the intrinsic level, some of them are to the extrinsic level, some of them are at the lower stages of the Maslow pyramid, some of them more at the higher. So this is just another way to describe that. Radov kind of put this into a four-field matrix in a sense. So on the x-axis of this diagram, whatever you want to call it, is the numbers of players, so increasing here from one to many, right? Okay, let's have that again. And on the y-axis, we're having something that corresponds here to high levels, which are correspond to intrinsic motivation, and low levels, which correspond to extrinsic motivation, right? Now let's look at these things. So here we have achievement motivation, right? So that's with very few players, normally, one or so. And if we have an extrinsic motivation, like I want to be better at a game, whatever, this is called achievement. Whereas here, if the numbers of players increase and we're still in the realm of extrinsic motivation, more to the quantitative side, we're talking about competition. Okay? Now, for few players and intrinsic motivation, we're in the world of immersion, right? So it's not so much about getting better, in a sense, but it's more about being just immersed in the game, being in there, and just kind of taking pleasure out of this. Whereas with the numbers of players increasing and we're more in this qualitative, intrinsic realm, we would switch from competition to cooperation. Yeah? So that's a very qualitative view here by Radov, right? Another element that is important in terms of motivation is clearly rewards. Okay. Wang and Sun kind of state that rewards provide meaning in games and outside of games. And in a sense, as I said last time as well, they provide social meaning. So rewards are used social metaphors. So you get points, you earn magic swords, you earn wealth, you earn a status, whatever. So these things are intrinsically social. And there's a lot of forms of these reward systems in games, which also can be transferred to things outside of games. That's a typical motif of gamification. So, scores, experiences, items, resources, feedback messages, which kind of, secure your motivational setting, unlocking of certain secrets, and so on. So, Wang and Sun come up with four different characteristics of reward, okay? So there's the social value, the effect that the reward has on the gameplay, whether it's suitable for collection or review. So with review, what they mean is that a person can kind of quantify the stage of her outcome. So if it's like kind of record, that's the level I reached, for example. And another characteristic, naturally, is the time required to earn or receive the reward. And what do people use that for? Okay, good. So rewards can be a mean of formal advancement. So whether you can progress to a next level can be a means of review. That's what I just said. Sense of accomplishment. How far did I get? Sociality and of cooperation and competition. Okay? Good. So these are things that point into the realm of motivation. Why do people use games? Why do they play games? Why would they use, in a sense, social media, which we will get to? Another thing is the emotions that people experience while they're playing. And surprisingly so, although we perceive the realm of emotions as something very complicated, the basic human emotions are really finite. So depending on which author you read, there is a few basic emotions. And based on the emotions, you can have more complex states, like moods, for example. Moods are, again, comprised of several basic emotions, in a sense. And then, if you accept that your amygdala, your brain, kind of colors your perceptions with emotions, and the emotions are kind of
ingredients that shape and augment your perceptions if the intellectual analytical level comes in and is mixed with emotions. Then we would have really complicated personality states in a sense. Yeah? And but the basic level is really simple.
And an important and famous characterization is Ekman's six emotions. So frustration, fear, surprise, sadness, and amusement. And as I said, the theory is that you should be able to come up with any mood or emotion-related effects in your brain as linear combinations of these, in essence. Now, a more fine-grained way of formalizing this is Plutchik's Wheel of Emotions, and Plutchik distinguishes eight of these basic emotions, which are listed here. And the wheel itself is built up as a color schema, such as the one that you know from school, so there are complementary colors, which are the opposite the opposite angle of the circle, which is true here as well, in a sense, and the emotions that are at the opposite ends kind of, contradict themselves, in a sense, or are the counter element. And there is also a degree of intensity in the emotions that is depicted via the color saturation here. So, for example, these positive things here range from ecstasy over joy to serenity and slight positive whatever emotions, right? And then they fade out. And the opposite of ecstasy is grief, right, in this formalization. And the opposite of admiration is loathing, yeah, verachtung. And these things are intended to really provide a framework for characterizing almost any mood or complex emotion. Like, for example, love is within these positive things related to joy and these positive things related to trust, right? And submission is something that is here in the trust region and the fear region and so on and so on. Naturally,
these things have their flaws, okay? So that's not the law. I think that most psychologists would question that system, but we're computer scientists, and if we want to include emotions, for example, when generating behavior of non-player characters, such as things that Daniel is working at, we need to come up with a simple formalization. So a typical conversation that I had with a psychologist at a conference went like this, okay? I approached the psychologist and said, okay, what we're interested in describing social relations. She said, okay, that's fine. And I said to her, what we're interested in is an ontology for social relations. And I said to her, okay, the reason why we're doing this is, you know that in social networking platforms, usually there is only one sort of social relation, like friendship or roles or something. And that's not very expressive, right? It's not very expressive when you think of privacy, so perhaps you want to reveal certain things to your parents or to your friends which you don't want to reveal to your fellow students, okay? And that's why Google Plus, for example, came up with circles. And that's what Facebook also did. You have these close friends, relatives, and all these things. However, we all know that it doesn't really work very well. At least that's my impression. So people would not really make intense use of that. And the psychologist, when I told her that, she said, well, that's so stupid and so naive. Why do I come up with an ontology for social relations? The world is too complex, okay? And you cannot do it. Good. However, I was a bit, well,
confused by that because I said, okay, it may be that the world is complex, but as computer scientists, we need to make models that can be processed with algorithms, at least if we're interested in that, right? We can certainly say that there's limits which we cannot really model in that fashion, but at least we're trying to, okay? And then the conversation was over. However, it turned out that she was right in a sense, because the attempt to really ontologize social relations is in a sense naive. And that's because, as we found out via researching the respective literature, among other reasons, social relations are too important for humans to kind of really demark them sharply in these ontological concepts. If you think of a four-year-old, yeah, when you were 4 years old in kindergarten, for example, you have the concept of a best friend, yeah? Now, Rita is my best friend. Now, Tobias is my best friend. And that changed every 2 weeks or so. But for a four-year-old, this was a sad concept. Mother, father, best friend, period, yeah? And as we grow up, things become more complicated, right? And I always have a difficulty of putting someone in the set of close friends and denying him or her or some others these steps, right? So I have a difficulty in saying who's a close friend and who's not. It's kind of a blurred boundary. Because in a sense, this description world that we describe social relations, it is a continuum, and it's hard for us to form classes that are really logically distinct and can be well described. Yeah? And that's why we changed our attempts into various other projects like describing relations on axes and so on. Yeah? And the same might be true for emotions. And this is just a space, a continuum, where you can describe them. And it may be well suited, but maybe in future research there'll be more fine-grained emotional description frameworks. So you might wonder, okay, good, why is this guy talking about emotions? We're doing computer science. Can we detect them? And the answer is probably yes. And the methods that are used are within the realm of social signal processing. So in your voice, in your face, there's expressions, involuntary expressions of your underlying emotions, which can be detected with computer vision methods and, for example, audio processing methods. And the accuracy is still not perfect, but it's surprisingly good, okay? And why is this? I mean, okay, a social signal or a behavioral cue is something that is at a higher level in a sense than just an underlying emotion. But our eyes and our ears are really finely trained towards recognizing these things. If you look into somebody's face, you know that it pretty easily can interpret the respective motions that somebody rises his elbow or eyebrow, then you know he's in doubt, right? Like, really? And that's a uniform social signal that's understood. And this is certainly accessible to algorithms. Good. Now, why do we look at emotions? The answer is because they fulfill certain functions. They support enjoyment, focus, attention, help in decision making, and even support our learning. Okay, if you think about serious games, for example, right? If there is, that's the whole idea of serious games, to come up with an emotionally appealing environment for learning. Okay. Good. Now, motivation and emotion kind of are really elements or produce engagement or involvement in the game. And there are, potentially four levels of intensity of involvement, okay? So, first one we might just call general involvement. Second one we might call presence or yeah, just the perceptual illusion that things are non-mediated, so I'm not having something really artificial and myself, so but I'm rather present in something. And the next level is immersion. I have the illusion of a second reality while interacting with the respective application. And the highest level of engagement is called flow. And that's something you're trying to achieve all the time. If you happen to get into a flow kind of engagement state, for example, while preparing for an exam, this is the best, because then you're really having fun. The hours pass by and look like minutes. Certainly, that's not very often happening, sadly enough, but it is the goal, right? And by flow, as you might have read, is this holistic sensation of feeling totally involved with something. And so this seems to be something that we want when we want to design games or other useful applications for people. Okay. Now, what are the characteristics of that flow? Okay. So first of all, we're really intensely concentrated on something. We cannot be easily distracted. If you're in a flow, the neighbor can play death metal at volumes you would just not recognize. Okay. There's a merging of action and awareness, so there's no separation between those things. We kind of lose our reflective self-consciousness, and we have, what is very important, a sense of total control of my actions. Okay? So being competent for solving any problem in a flow state is a real, really important characteristic. So if you're in a state of, well, not being able to do something and not having control of something, then you cannot be really in a flow environment, because that acting and the possibility to act is really an important element here. Fifth thing is you're losing your usual sense of time. So hours pass by as minutes, and this activity is perceived as being really intrinsically rewarding. Yeah, so in a flow state, you're not thinking about goals and rewards and in an extrinsic sense. You're just thinking about, oh, how nice is this? And naturally, there are conditions. And one condition is that you have an engaging challenge. And this challenge must be at the really appropriate level of your skills. If it's beyond that level, you're feeling anxious and feeling, well, I cannot cope with that. If it's below that level, you're feeling bored, okay? The goals must be clear and proximal, so they need to be really in time and space. They need to be at your hands. And the feedback with respect to your actions towards these goals must be immediate, okay? And what I just said is just depicted in these three diagrams, okay? So at the very left, there is a diagram that just states that. So at the x-axis, our capabilities are depicted, our skills, okay? So growing skills, higher x value. And at the y-axis, the challenges are depicted. And if you have a low skill level and low challenges, probably you can get into something like a casual flow, okay? But typically what you want is that you have a high or intermediate skill level and an appropriate level of challenges. So the flow would only have a chance to occur here at the diagonal. If you're above the diagonal, so you have low skills but high challenges, then you get anxious. And if you have high skills and low challenges, you get bored. Okay? That's precisely what's in there. And that's more like a refinement where this region here is kind of looked at more thoroughly. So if you have low skills and low challenges, normally, I said maybe you can have something like a casual flow, but that's not a true flow in the sense of as it is totally immersing, yeah, and totally focusing and concentration evolving, right? So what they call this region is just apathy, right? You don't have anything that challenges you, but you don't have any skills. You're just like a squid in the ocean, okay? And that's the most refined version, which kind of distinguishes here between certain stages, okay? So this original flow, which was here and here, is still present, but if you're going to more in this region, where you would still have high skills and comparatively still a bit lower challenges, you're having a sense of control, but not a real sense of flow. You can handle things, it's nice, but the challenges are not that rewarding. And here you can say, oh, yeah, okay, I can handle almost anything. And the other way around, yeah? Flow, arousal, anxiety, worry, yeah? Just depending on these relations. Now, flow is certainly something that we want to achieve, but people would always come up saying the game should be fun. Okay, good. So what's fun? So if you're in a state of flow, is flow really fun? It's not necessarily congruent, but flow is something that is perceived as very satisfying. And while you're in a state of having fun, a certain degree of experiencing satisfaction is certainly necessary, but as you know by just thinking about these things, these are not the same. However, this is really a very informal reality. And some game researchers have tried to come up with classifications of fun. And we just picked out one. I just picked out one, and there's others in the background reading literature that I put online for you. But these are so-called 8 kinds of fun. However, it's more like motives that are kind of related to fun. So, for example, we can have fun in the sense of sense pleasing. Yeah, we have a sensation while we do something. Or we're having fun because of the make-believe fantasy narrative kind of structures in the game. Yeah, or we can have fun because of the challenges and the way we master them. That's, in the ideal case, leads to flow. Yeah? This is important for us, fun via social success, in a sense. So you have success in creating a guild or something, and so on and so on. Okay? And even this last point, you can even have fun being submissive. In a sense, you submit yourself to the game while you're trying to spend time with it, right? So you have fun via the immersive effects, right? So you submit yourself to the structure itself. Good. So coming to the, last few slides on that. Good. Speaking of this social play that we're after, okay. There's a publication from 2009 that lists here 4 elements of social play. Okay. And the first one they called emotional contagion. Okay. So that's about the emotions of somebody influencing my emotions. Yeah. Someone is so funny and so nice and so happy. Sense of emotion that is contagious. I'm also happy because of interacting with that person. So we try to mimic expressions, vocalizations, and postures and synchronize with them, right? There's things like halo effects and so on. And what this leads to is emotional convergence. Okay? If, let's say,
did you come together for your lactose in a group of six? Okay, you know that you have to do the lactose group that do some sketches. Okay, but there's two possibilities. Either you were kind of caught in a downward spiral because like two persons are rather negatively inclined emotionally, and the others also become negatively inclined, and then there's an atmosphere of hate, oh, come on, this and the sketches, wow, idiot. But it could also be a positive spiral. So that's emotional convergence. In the end, you'll end up feeling, having the same attitudes emotionally, right? Social play or social interaction while playing also has an interesting aspect in terms of performance. And you know that your performance is different when you act on your own compared to when you act in a social environment, right? So if you ever have the chance to give a lecture, then you will certainly experience these things, okay? So remember the beginning of this lecture when I was talking about types and genres. So obviously, when I sat in my office and try to think of this parallel with art history, the definition of genre and type is totally clear to me. Yeah? Now, I came here, I walked here, and I knew I had to give a lecture, and you were looking at me, like, okay, explain to me what a genre is. Okay, come on. And the effect of decreasing your mental ability and your mental performance under observation, or at least the change in your performance, can be really substantial, right? So there's this thing of, I have a total block. I am blocked, right? And that's a very displeasing sensation, but it can happen. If you're supposed to deal with, like, an IQ test under observation, you would certainly perform worse. And I'm really a victim of that. If people would expect me to do some intellectual feats under observation, I would just become rigid and say that it's not really, yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I'm very certain that the list performed better there a lot. Whereas, I mean, in most of the cases, they actually perform worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, why is there better?
Okay, good. So that's different. Yeah, sorry. This should really be different. Okay. Now, good. So there's the opposite effect as well, right? So certainly, if you kind of there's effects of concentration, right? So, but this is only the beginning, right? If you're in the same situation and you're being watched, naturally your anxiety level is raised. Compared, now my anxiety level, when I talk to you, is slightly raised compared to sitting in my office. And we know from social psychology that a little bit of anxiety will just improve your performance. However, in most cases, these observational effects will find a different direction. Very many people observe you, and if the reactions are neutral, or doubting, or negative, then these things become really a negative thing. So here it should really be different. Okay?
And by this Hawthorne effect, which is cited on the slides, we just mean that there's a general change in human behavior under observation. Okay? That makes sense. We could correct that. Perform differently. Okay. Good. Now there's also, aspects of social play that point towards learning, because obviously learning in humans is in very many cases guided by analogous reasoning, right? So, for example, children learn from their parents by imitating their behavior. And you can learn in a social play environment as from observation of others, okay? Good. And the last thing is something that we already talked about. So relationship building and, well, maintaining relationships and using play as a means to maintain relationships is certainly also a key element or function of social play. So the real last aspect here in these introductory slides on games is studies on communities and social networks in digital games. Okay? Good. So, our group at Professor Schlichter's chair has been doing research on communities since the late 1990s or so. Now, you might ask yourself, why did you just found Facebook and this Zuckerberg guy to come along? Well, that's something some people in our group might ask themselves, I don't know. But there's a long history of that research in general, virtual communities, and we'll look at that more thoroughly. And in games, naturally, these studies would live or work in these MMOG worlds, okay? They might kind of do research on cooperation. They might do research on how people use the media and so on and so on. What is appealing about social games and social media, in contrast to traditional group research and sociology, is that you have large amounts of data at your hand, which you didn't have 20 years ago. Okay? So, in a sense, a sociologist and a psychologist 20 or 25 years ago would have to work traditionally with qualitative methods or quantitative methods such as questionnaires, but they would, in many cases, have to observe, yeah, small groupings in a sense, or they would have to be bound to looking at stuff like political parties and so on by studying news articles or something. However, social media and social games provide us with the possibility of being able to look at the Homo sapiens in its natural habitat, right? Since the real and virtual world is not that separate anymore, what happens in Facebook is, in a sense, a mirror of true human behavior. Right? Not in all aspects, but in some. And the same applies to games. So what we can deduct or record is large data sets and then do statistical analysis on that. Okay? Good. There's also study of how the in-game and out-game social relations are related, what they impose on one another. But that's something that we just at the moment don't want to look at into detail. So, speaking of the research methods, I just mentioned them briefly. So there are qualitative methods. So coming from ethnography, participant observation, and what you can do in that field is conduct structured interviews. That's one thing. You can do focus groups that are typically taped on video or at least recorded audio-wise. And then once you conducted these interviews or focus group studies, you would have to qualitatively reason about what conclusions can be drawn from that. And the method is just argumentation with citations from the interviews, okay? Mainly. Now, surveys are either quantitative or qualitative version. So if you're asking like 1,000 people which party are you probably going to vote for, then you know 1,000 is roughly representative in a statistical hypothesis testing sense for the whole population of the country. So we're pretty sure that if we ask 1,000 persons, we would have a pretty close prediction of the actual results. Now that would be a quantitative method. And what you use is statistics and hypothesis testing. Okay? Now, if you have these large data sets, achieved or gained or recorded via crawling or logs or whatever you have, you can do this other type of quantitative analysis, like clustering or trying to come up with classifiers and stuff. And so here we're more in the realm of machine learning, of Bayesian statistics. Yeah. And so that's more if you look at continuous data. If you have discrete data like friendships in Facebook, for example, what you can do with that is social network analysis. Right? So you know that there are nodes and nodes are persons, and the persons are related to other persons via edges. And these are complicated networks that have a certain topology, like small worlds, for example, and that have clusters, cliques, plexus, cores, centroids, whatever you want here, right? You can investigate centrality. All these things are something that we're going to look at. In the realm of games, what you can use that for is, for example, to detect gold farms. And these are persons that in massively multiplayer online role-playing games professionally collect items or gain wealth in terms of these artificial currencies that circulate around there. And then they sell these virtual statuses or items or swords or whatever magical powers to other people. And they sell it using real money. And actually, the people that run these games or promote them or whatever create them would have something against that practice. Yeah? And then there was even an incident of a murder taking place in China because one person would refuse to sell another person some magical item from WFW. Right? So this guy took a real knife and put it in the real body of another person. So this is something that you don't want to have, and social network analysis can help you in detect people that violate the game spirit in that sense. This is something in the lab course we will look at in the third task. Okay? Good. So, these ecosystems of player communities are in a sense nested, right? So the spectrum ranges from the interpersonal relationships, so that's certainly at the micro level, yeah, dyads, triads, cliques or something. And at the meso level, there is player guilds, communities, groupings of tens, hundreds, even a few thousands of persons. And at the highest level, we're more at the realm of subcultures, if you want. Yeah? So there's player societies and stuff like that. So that's the range where you can do research. Okay? Good. And the aspects that people research those social structures with respect to our self-organization, right? So how do people organize themselves either short-term or long-term? What is their leadership structure? How would they manage and run these things? What are types of persons, types of players? What are the rationales? So why do people form these groups? And so on and so on. Yeah. Good. Another interesting thing is the relationship between the player and avatars in the game. Okay. This has been extensively researched in terms of Second Life, which has now become an obsolete thing. So nobody talks about Second Life anymore. But like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, I'm not really sure, everybody was kind of thinking about whether this would really evolve into kind of second reality. People would, make their avatars clothes and would develop styles or would project their wishes to their avatars, like equipping them with lots of muscles or other elements, whatever you want. And so that's an interesting relation, and we're currently aiming to set up a project with a lot of people from Weihenstephan, and the goal of that project, among others, is to do research on how ICT structures like apps and avatars and UI elements of augmented reality can help people in controlling their nutritional behavior. Yeah, can stop them from overeating, can educate them and bring them to a healthier lifestyle. And that's interesting because the efforts that were taken up to now always have this educational type of approach. So you must eat more bananas and potato chips are evil. Okay? Now, who cares? I mean, yeah, sure, apples are better than potato chips, but potato chips is something that people crave for, right? Burgers and all this evil stuff. Now, education is not, obviously not a thing that like a 30-year-old would care for, right? 30-year-old having the chance, should I go in my school break to McDonald's or should I like buy some eco, whatever, bio-marked super-style food, right? And that's an interesting thing, and for example, Gudrun Klinke is doing research on that, interesting stuff, yeah? Learning and how learning takes place, I already elaborated on that in Serious Games. There is a lot of research on how people act antisocially. There is link prediction efforts, right? So link prediction is certainly an even traditional field in social computing. So in essence, you have a network structure and other data, and you're trying to predict who is probably or who does have a high probability to connect with who else, okay? That is interesting for person recommenders, expert search, and others, yeah? And even the whole range of recommender systems, okay? And people would also do research on technology and technological aspects, for example, how latency affects social interaction, okay? So you might know the effect if you have latency in a conversation, like audio latency, this is kind of a really disturbing effect that you just cannot ignore, yeah? Because why is that? The mechanisms of turn-taking, yeah? So the mechanisms of when do you take the conversational, the role of the one speaking from somebody else, is something that is really fine-grained in our behavior. So there's indicators, acoustic indicators like that indicate you want to take the turn now. There's stuff like raising your hands, which is another way of turn taking here in this learning environment and so on and so on. And you know that these mechanisms are rather subtle. Yeah. You know that from persons that cannot really handle that well, they really perceive as already wrong. Yeah. And so the latency, the technological latency, would kind of interfere with these social, learned social habits. You can not apply them anymore in an appropriate sense because your brain is not used to that latency. And even if it's just like 50 milliseconds, 500 milliseconds. And people that do electronic music, for example, know really well about latency. Yeah? For example, if you play electric guitar, the standard solution is a Marshall amp and a Gibson guitar, right? And this is rather analog type of hardware stuff, okay? So you're playing a chord, and since there's no digital things involved in the processing chain, the sound would be at your ears almost immediately. And for players of instruments, this feedback is really important in terms of when you do an action, how would that be translated to sound. And if you use digital amplifiers, then the better the digital amplifiers have a latency that is below your perceptual threshold, but the worst ones would have a latency of around like 15
milliseconds or so, and that's certainly perceivable. And you have an indirect feeling. You hit the chord, but the sound comes a little late.
That's just at the fringe of your perception, and it kind of really influences your play. And the same applies to social interactions in games. Okay? Good. Now, last thing here, sorry, this was not last, but now we're really sure. Let's just look at this
as the last slide.
Okay?
Now, we talk about social play and its characteristics, and this is more or less a wrap up or a overall classification if you want. So, the first diagram is about the actual spatio-temporal context of play, right?
One axis here, oops, please cursor show up, thank you, thank you, thank you. So this axis here is about the degree of reality that we have in the game or application or whatever. And it ranges from real-world environments, augmented reality, augmented virtuality to pure virtual environments. Okay? The temporal axis, it could be something that is what Henry called persistent versus transient. Okay? And the space here would range from really extended spaces like Second Life, World of Warcraft, and so on, single points and stuff that is almost no space or has no space at all. Textual stuff, textual games, and so on. The interaction is can be characterized in terms of that diagram here. Now here on this axis we have the communication mode, so the degree of synchronicity, whether the communication is rather asynchronous as in discussion boards or rather synchronous as talking face to face. The interaction paradigm, whether players would really interact with others, whether they would just interact with more or less intelligent objects or non-player characters, or whether the player would just be interacting with the world itself, which is rather passive in a sense. Yeah? And so the active-passive axis is here. Yeah? So it's clear that you can just experience things like more in a movie-like setting or being really active. And the last stuff is this diagram, number of players from massively multiplayer to just single. The motivation, one aspect of it, intrinsic, extrinsic, and the supporting technology. So with Seamful and Seamless, what we mean is that if you talk about cross-media or cross-platform applications, if you have something on the web, something on your mobile device, something as an app on the mobile device, something as software or whatever, what you want is that these things seamlessly are integrated with one another. And the same is true for games and interactions. So if the technology has a lot of breaks in it, it's certainly not beneficial for this immersive flow-like interaction that you would strive for. Okay? Now that's just concluding subsumption in a sense of what we talked about. And if you want, you can pretty much place any social play concept in these three spaces. There might be others. It's not claiming to be complete, but this is a way to do it, okay? Good, so that's what is explained here, but in essence, these three slides just sum that up, okay? Good, well, that was a rather quick look at social games and games in particular, and a lot of the frameworks and stuff. One more time, to repeat that, I went over these things rather quickly and coarsely, and the reason why I did that is because I had the feedback from the previous year's class that people would find this rather boring. Now, those of you that do not
find that boring. You can find a lot of more details in the background reading script, where we linked a lot of papers and a lot of books. And if you're interested in some of them or can get some of them, I have them and I'm happy to provide you with that. And if you happen to be interested in some of these aspects, like motivational psychology and so on and so on, we can manage to point you to more literature on that, right? Second thing, since I went over these things rather coarsely, just to give you a rough overview, and since these things are rather, well, complicated to learn in a sense, because if you really want to dig deeper, the amount of literature that you would have to read kind of exponentially increases. This is not a good subject for the exam. So that's why I excluded this first slide set from the exam. It's just as a background, as a setting for us in terms of introducing some notions. So that's why this lecture was like that. So the upcoming lectures would be would go into more detail. And so next slide set is on social media, which is still a bit soft, but then we would immediately dig into social network analysis, which then becomes mathematically rigorous. Last thing, the slides are always built like that. So there's the slides, blah, blah, blah. And at the end, there's a bibliography, more or less extensive. And then there is what I recommend as a way to interact with these things. And there's always three levels. Yeah? So the minimal approach is for those of you that think, okay, I want to have a bachelor in games engineering, or I want to have a master in computer science, whatever you want, yeah? But I would just want the credits. Yeah? And I would always remember this oral exam with one guy. He was really brilliant. He knew anything and had really dug into everything very deeply. And at the end of the exam, I said to him, okay, cool, you have a very good mark. And I'm very pleased that people are so interested in things. And he said, to be honest, I'm not interested at all in these things. I just want the credits. Okay, that's fine, okay? So that's for the people that really just want to kind of pass. And then the standard approach would be the things that I would recommend for those that, as the school word suggests, the normal students, where we would have to study the slides and read one background reading. Yeah? In this case, the corresponding parts of this background text. However, you don't have to read really all of that. Just it out. And the interested students approach would be standard plus additional suggestions for reading. And that's always at each end of each slide set, these things would be like that. And last but not least, there's the questions section. Okay? Now, since I took that out of the exam, these questions might not be too interesting for you, but in the introductory session, I explained the idea of the exam. Yeah? 25 questions where I take 40% out of this pool that is at the end of each slide. And what you can do is try to go through the questions and try to answer them in one way or another. Yeah? For example, name four characteristics of play from these two guys. Yeah? Or try to explain Argon must be a government a Liga mimicry of Ilix from Kalmar, right? So what was that about? What was Ilix? Don't remember, right? So these questions are intended to guide you through the process of remembering, structuring, and extracting what's interesting from you. Okay? And I was inspired by that, actually by a math exam of a friend of mine. She studied in Sweden, and she had a type of exam which was really cool, I think. So the professor gave her 10 problems, which were really hard, and she had to do a lot of digging and proving and computing for that. And but the exam was solely on those 10 problems, right? So that's a fair thing. You can prepare pretty much ahead. You learn a lot. You try to network the concepts. And if you do that properly, the exam shouldn't pose any sinister obstacles, any tricky, sinister, I'm more clever than you type stuff, yeah? Which is simply not useful, right? So that's the idea behind it.
You can come up with suggestions if you think that's stupid or can be done better. Just communicate it to me. And that's that, and we'll meet on Tuesday. Yeah, have a nice Easter.